Welcome to the Forest Path Podcast, a podcast sharing the teachings of awakened meditation masters of the modern era. In this episode of the Forest Path Podcast, I'll be completing the narration of the teaching Only the World Ends by the Forest Meditation Master, Venerable Ajahn Chetet. This is part two of two episodes. Stay tuned to listen to the concluding part of this teaching by a true meditation master of the Thai forest tradition. This teaching was published for free distribution by Patana Suksa Publishing in Bangkok. May you all benefit from hearing this gift of Dhamma. At the time of death, the mind ceases first, followed by the body. One may see in a dead person that although the mind has ceased all its activity, the body is still warm. The cells and organs, the nervous system still remain. Those people who revive after doctors have pronounced them dead resume using the same cells. When the mind enters and inhabits this body, it grasps at every single part of it as being mine and goes on doing so until the last moment of life when the body is about to perish. After death, beings experience the results of the actions they performed while still in the human realm and may be reborn as disembodied beings, perhaps as a kind of spirit or hungry ghost or as a deity. If then they show themselves to people, it can be seen that they exhibit the characteristics they formerly possessed. Those who formerly committed evil, had defiled minds and soiled bodies, appear in that way, whereas those that did good, were pure-minded and had attractive appearances, look that way. Even beings who fall into hell realms after death can show those realms clearly and vividly to human beings. However, the average person lacks the faculties to see them, for after death, all that remains of those beings is the mind and energy of the volitional actions they have performed. Having taken birth in the human realm, we grasp onto this human body as being mine with great tenacity. The intelligent person cleanses his mind of its impurities with the practice of samadhi until he realizes the heart and attains the state of equanimity which is devoid of past and future. It is in this way that the liberation from all defilement may be known. Samadhi pertains to the mind, but I hold it to be matter of the body and speech also, because body and speech are always implied by the presence of mind. When there is mind, there is thought, which is internal speech. With the very arising of thought, there is speech. When speech is present, the mind goes out roaming amongst the material forms of beings and people and the world of objects. Without these things, the mind would have nothing to latch onto. However coarse or subtle the mind is, whether it is dwelling in the realm of sensuality, form or formlessness, it must always have a tangible base. There must be the internal and external sense fields, contact between them, and a constant sense of knowing. Even formless realm consciousness has the formless mind itself as its dwelling place. The person who enters the formless levels of meditative absorption perceives the formless mind with the internal sense fields. The term internal sense fields does not, in this case, have the customary meaning of eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body and mind, but refers to the internal sense fields of the heart. When one has detached oneself from the core sense fields of eyes, ears, etc., a further set remains intact, the eyes, ears, etc., that are called dibba, heavenly or divine. For instance, in the case of seeing, it is not the normal material eye that sees, but the eye of the heart. And the form perceived is not the kind seen by the ordinary eye, but one specific to the heart's eye. The same principle applies to the same way to other senses and objects. The contact between these internal sense fields and their respective objects is a great deal more intense and experienced than that between their coarser counterparts, and it is a private contact, one unperceivable by other people. These internal sense fields of the heart are difficult things to talk about. Those who have never meditated on the point of reaching the heart cannot understand them. Our everyday language does not lend itself to such matters. The best that one can do is to employ similes. There is no complete agreement in the ways of practice amongst those who are still not adept, even those who use the same meditation object. In the case of senior monks with many disciples, this disparity can have serious consequences. So we should take the basic principles of the Buddha's teachings as our foundation. Are we or are we not practicing correctly in accordance with the teachings of Buddhism? The scriptures are to be used as a measuring stick of our practice. We shouldn't just do as we see fit. There is only one teaching, only one Buddha, but nowadays his disciples are following different paths. It is a great shame and disgrace. The internal sense fields that I have been talking about are also deceptive. One can't take them too seriously. All things that exist in the world are a mixture of the true and the false. Every single worldly condition, whether an object, a creature, or a human being, is deceptive. The mind enmeshed in the world deceives itself into taking things to be substantial. However, all things are illusory. Having arisen, their nature is to degenerate and disappear. Human beings, for example, are born from a combination of the four elements. The mind grasps onto that lump of elements and labels it as a human being, man or woman. Then there is marriage and children are born. There is love and hate, envy, harm and killing. It's the same with making a living. Having been born into this world, we have to work to stay alive. We work in a shop or on a farm or as a civil servant, but even if we work until the day we die, we don't finish anything. When we die, someone else takes our place, and before they can get anything done, they die as well. As long as this world still exists, we human beings are all born into it to keep doing the same things over and over again. When we die, not one of us can take the fruits of our labours with us. Even our bodies are left behind. Only the good and evil actions we have performed survive the body's death. It is nothing strange that the perceived animate world is able to deceive the mind when even the inanimate world can do so. We can see this with woods and forests. The many species of trees growing lushly green, branches garlanded with blossoms and clusters of fruit, pleasingly arrayed with a beauty and order beyond human artifice. Anyone who sees such a scene admires it and praises its beauty. Then there are the cliff faces, the overhangs, caves and grottos, strangely ordered as if carefully sculpted by an unknown hand. There are rivers and streams flowing down from the highlands to the plains, with their oxbows and bends, gorges and cliff, eddies and whirlpools, and with circling shoals of darting fish. These are impressive sights, and as one keeps dwelling on their beauty, one loses oneself in the enjoyment of them, and they come to seem substantial and real. But after a while they disappear from our memory, or if not, we become separated from them. Nothing survives. All is impermanent. This power to deceive that is possessed by the things of the world is shared by the Dhamma that is still of the world. One can observe this in the practice of sitting meditation. As the mind converges into samadhi, there can be a feeling as if one has been given a shove, and one is suddenly stricken with fear. Or sometimes there may be a loud cracking sound like a peal of thunder, or perhaps the body seems to break into pieces, or else a clear bright light appears illuminating all sorts of objects. We believe these things to be real, but as soon as we open our eyes, they disappear. Anything can happen. Sometimes, as the mind unifies, one sees spirits and ghosts, the faces of ogres and devils, and frightened one flees. Some people go crazy. The Dhamma that is still mundane can deceive us in exactly the same way as other worldly things. Perhaps we contemplate this body as being unattractive. When we develop a firm conviction that is the true nature of the body, the perception of asubha manifests, the whole body is seen as bloated and rotting. But in fact, the body in its normal everyday state, unbloated and unrotting, is already unattractive. We are misled into believing the mind's deceptions and taking loathsomeness to be ultimately true. We cling to the perception until everything seems to stink. Wherever we go, we smell the odour of decay. The mind that we are training to realise Dhamma can still be deceived by the Dhamma that is still mundane, and so the Buddha said, "The mind deceives the mind." How can we observe if that is true? It is difficult if we do not know the difference between the mind and the heart. The mind and the heart are two different things. The heart here means, as it does in everyday usage, that which lies at the center. The mind is thought, ideation, conceptualization, imagination, memory, and perception, all the myriad mental phenomena. Although people generally take the heart and the mind to be identical, and in the Thai language the words are often used interchangeably, the mind and heart can be separated. Sometimes the Buddha said that the mind, the citta, is naturally radiant but is sullied by adventitious defilement, and in other places that the mind is defiled. He spoke in many different ways, and the students of heart and mind have become quite confused. Looked at on a basic level, mind is thought, imagination, conceptualization, all the different kinds of mental process. It is difficult to bring under our control. Even when we are asleep, the mind still roams about creating the worlds for itself that we call dreams. It imagines us doing our daily tasks of farming, buying, and selling, and so on, perhaps quarrelling, fighting, and killing. If we train this restless mind of ours to experience the tranquility of one-pointedness, we will see that the one-pointed mind exists separately from the defilements such as anger and so on. The mind and the defilements are not identical. If they were, purification of mind would be impossible. Through its fabrications, the mind brings defilement into itself and then becomes unsure as to exactly what is the mind and what defilement. The Buddha taught, Chittang pabhasarang agantukehi kelesehi. The mind is unceasingly radiant. Defilements are alien entities that enter into it. This saying shows that his teaching on the matter is in fact clear. For the world to be the world, every one of its constituent parts must be present. The only thing that stands by itself is Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha. Anyone who considers Dhamma to be manifold or composite has not yet penetrated it thoroughly. Water is, in its natural state, a pure, transparent fluid. But if dye stuff is added to it, it will change colour accordingly. If red dye is added, it will turn red. If black dye, black. But even though water may change its colour in accordance with the substances introduced into it, it does not forsake its innate purity and colourlessness. If an intelligent person is able to distill all the coloured water, it will resume its natural state. The dye stuff can only cause variation in outer appearance. Water is a very useful substance. It is capable of cleansing all sorts of soiled things, and similarly, one's own purity can permeate all despoiling agents and wash them away. The wise are able to distill or filter the mind so as to remove the defilements with which it is adulterated. Now let me explain the differences between the heart and the mind before talking about the defilements that arise from the mind. The term mind refers to mental activity. All volitions and perceptions arise from the mind. The mind is unable to remain motionless. Even during sleep, it is creating and imagining a host of different things in dream. It can't stay and it cannot sleep. It makes no discrimination in its workings of night and day. It is the body, not the mind, which being weary rests. The mind is formless. It can penetrate any place. It can even pass through all the way through a large mountain. The mind has more powers than can be fully described. The heart is that which lies at the center of things and is also formless. It is simple awareness, devoid of movement to and fro, of past and future, within and without, merit and harm. Wherever the center of a thing lies, there lies its heart, for the word heart means centrality. In conversation, if a person is asked about his heart, he will point to the center of his chest. In fact, that is not the heart itself, it is merely the heart base, the organ that recycles blood and pumps it back into circulation so as to nourish and maintain the various parts of the body. The heart I am referring to is not a material object, it is formless. Usually in the scriptures, the terms the mind and the heart signify the same thing. The Buddha said, however the mind is, so is the heart. However the heart, so the mind. That the two terms are synonymous can be seen in the sayings such as Chittang Dantang Sukhavahang, the well-trained mind brings forth happiness, and Manopubang Gama Dhamma, all things are preceded by the heart. In most cases, the Buddha used the word mind, and in the Abhidhamma, mind and mental objects are the only terms used. This is probably because the mind plays a more prominent role than the heart, both the defilements and the cleansing of the defilements being functions of the mind. The defilements are not the mind. The mind is not defilement. The mind grasps onto defilements and causes them to proliferate. If the mind and defilements were one and the same thing, who in the world could possibly cleanse the mind completely? The mind and defilements are without tangible form. When there is seeing or hearing, for example, the defilements that appear are not inherent properties of the eyes and ears. They arise in dependence on the contact between the mind and the sense field. When, for instance, a form comes into contact with the eye, that contact gives birth to a feeling, which after a while disappears. The mind, seeking to retain that feeling in consciousness, causes the defilements of good and evil, love and hate, to appear. One who doesn't understand this process is misled into thinking that the mind and defilements are identical, and so applies remedies to the mind rather than defilements themselves. Consequently, however, many remedies one applies, one meets with no success because one's efforts are wrongly directed. It is through deludedly grasping onto all kinds of objects and supports as being mine, through becoming firmly attached to things, that the mind becomes defiled. Gardens and fields, wealth and possessions, husband and wife, sons and daughters, all the members of our family are taken to be mine, and so the mind becomes defiled. But all those things exist in accordance with their own nature. They are not affected by our deluded clinging. For example, from delusion we cling to our spouse, assuming him or her to be really ours. We feel as if we have taken their heart and placed it within our own. But if they decide to commit adultery, they don't say a word to us, and when we find out, we are heartbroken and almost die from the anguish. This suffering arises from delusion, not perceiving the way that things actually exist. It is even more the case with inanimate objects. We put precious stones, diamonds, and sapphires away in a sturdy safe, afraid that thieves will steal them. The stones themselves are completely indifferent. They would feel nothing at all if they were stolen. The one who would be frantic and upset would be their owner, the one who clings. The defilement of clinging is really malevolent. There is nothing that may not be clung to. Having grasped hold of something, the clinging embeds itself immovably within it. The mind, the heart, and defilements have the meanings I have explained above. The mind that has not been well trained will be continually overwhelmed by defilements, while conversely, the mind that has been well trained will become an immense treasure trove. The mind is both that which searches for defilement and that which seeks out wisdom. The birthplace of the mind's defilements is no other than the six sense fields, which the mind make regular use of. The six sense fields are the priceless wealth of the mind, as much as one could say, as if they were its wish-fulfilling gem. The eyes can be used to enjoy even the most beautiful and attractive forms without hesitation, and even if they become damaged or deficient in some way, you can still wear glasses. The ears are even better servants. When the eyes are closed, the ears can carry on listening and hearing quite comfortably. The nose is the same. It doesn't need to borrow the services of the eyes and ears to smell odours for it. It can manage by itself. The tongue doesn't need to bargain with the eyes, ears, nose to come and taste flavours for it. As soon as something is put into the mouth, whatever it is, the tongue immediately performs the function of discriminating whether the taste is spicy or salty, sweet or sour, delicious or not. The body acknowledges whether contact is soft, hard, or whatever. The heart is especially independent. It knows what thoughts are going on without having to concern itself with any of the other sense fields or consciousness. Its functions are specific to the heart. These things are old now. They have been serving the mind for so long that they are completely fluent. But be a little careful, because old things that we have been using for a long time, things that have provided us with pleasure and comfort over a long period, may still turn against us at any time. As the old saying warns, never trust an old slave, a cobra, or a loving wife. They may turn on you at any time. Having understood the explanations of heart, mind, and defilements, a person who wishes to extirpate the defilements from the mind must first practice samadhi until he is adept. Only then will he be able to separate the two, for without samadhi, the attempt to cleave the mind from the defilements will be ineffectual, and the two will remain fused. Samadhi means the state in which the mind is firmly established on a single object, at rest from external wandering, and it is the ground for the battle with the defilements. The mind that is darting out in search of sense experience is darting out in search of defilements. If we are simply aware, not allowing the mind to attach undue importance to sense experience, not interpreting and discoursing mentally upon it, if there is merely the bare knowing of it, defilement will not occur. For the mind to become defiled, it must take note of the sense data, dwell on it, and proliferate. If there is simply the knowing, there is no defilement. However, if the eye sees a form and there is a perception of it as man, woman, black, white, attractive, unattractive, and so on, and then the mind thinks and proliferates in various ways on these perceptions, then defilements will follow in their train, blanketing the mind's natural luminosity. Consequently, the state of samadhi degenerates and the defilements envelope the heart. When the ears hear a sound, it is exactly the same. If there is merely hearing, no labeling, thinking about it or proliferating on that sound, just letting the sound arise and pass away without adding to it, then as when a forest dweller hears the sound of birds or a waterfall, no defilement takes place. This same principle applies to the other sense fields. The mind of the one who has become adept can enter samadhi at the moment of sense contact and is able to relate to phenomena in the above manner, free of proliferation and subsequent defilement. But such a cleansing of the mind is of only temporary duration. It is dependent on the strength and fluency of samadhi. If samadhi is weak, it will be completely ineffectual, for true purification of mind, insight is required. Jhana, samadhi, and science all use the immaterial to investigate materiality, but they differ in significance and purpose. I would like to recap the explanations of the first two terms a little to refresh your memories. In jhana, the immaterial, for instance, the mind, concentrates on the material. For instance, it looks intently at the body in terms of the four elements. The mind develops a firm conviction that our body truly is a compound of those things until a nimitta of one of them appears. Sometimes in the course of the contemplation, the meditator may perceive some compelling vision and be deceived into taking it for real, thus taking fright, or in a small number of cases, even becoming mentally deranged. There are a great deal more possible experiences. They all lie within the province of jhana. In samadhi, the contemplation proceeds in the same way, but encompasses both the internal and external aspects of the object, unlike jhana, in which one perceives only the internal. In samadhi, one sees the body as being asubha, rotting, putrescent, and offensive, but at the same time retains the feeling that ultimately there is nothing truly repulsive about it at all. The unattractive aspects of the body are merely natural phenomena. It is just the nature of the body to be that way. In science, to understand something, you have to contemplate it until there develops a steady concentration on the way it exists. For instance, from the contemplation of anatomical structure, seeing the nature of the different parts of the body, how they combine and cooperate to perform the necessary movements and functions, textbooks are written and studies perpetuated. This is science and it has its place. Without it, the world would be poorer, for technology born of science is the tool by which the modern world has been created. Those people who hold the tools of technology are those who are still attached to the world and fascinated by it. Some people reach 100 years of age and still desire for 50 or 60 more. Scientists don't complete their building of an ideal world. They die first. They are replaced by others who also in their turn meet death. Deaths and births, births and deaths, there is no end to it. The majority of scientists tend to be of the opinion that physical death is the end, or if not, that whatever realm we are born in this life will be our destination in the next. There can be no change of station. They don't believe in karma or its results, even though they are performing karma continuously. Scientists tend to believe that man is a product of society, science, and material conditions. They do not accept the teaching of karma, of merit and harm. They do not believe that such immaterial forces can be the cause of material realities. However, the Buddha and all the sages have conviction in karma and its results. We have all been revolving on the wheel of birth and death for a countless number of existences through karma. In our lives, before we have finished our working out the old karma, we make more. It's like this every lifetime. The Buddha described it in terms of three vattas. Birth is vipakavatta. We are born due to the results of old karma. And once born, we are compelled to perform karmic actions, if not good, then evil, which is called kammavatta. The performance of karma demands volition, and when that volition is defiled, it is called kilesavatta. The result of defiled volition is vipakavatta, and vipakavatta means rebirth. The sages see the painful implications of birth and become disillusioned with it. They look for a means to arrest further birth, and so to that end they practice jhana and samadhi and develop wisdom and vipassana, the clear and penetrative seeing of things as they actually exist until they let go of all clinging. Then the mind, now purified, becomes the heart and all defilements are left behind. Science concentrates its investigations on a subject until the subject's true nature is clearly perceived by the intellect, and then the findings are recorded in textbooks for posterity. Science deals with materiality, with the external. In the practice of Dhamma, one develops jhana and samadhi and vipassana wisdom until one perceives the true nature of the subject under investigation. It differs from science in that the subject, ourselves, is both material and immaterial, and the instrument of perception is not intellect but pure mind. You are unable to record your findings in a tangible way, but may communicate them to fellow wayfarers. Those who give Dhamma discourses should be careful that they do not unintentionally allow talk of jhana to become talk of samadhi or science, or talk of samadhi to become talk of jhana or science. These three things are very similar. People who practice Dhamma are often impatient. They want to run before they can walk. They die before they are born. While still at the stage of concentration on a preliminary object, even before the state of samadhi has been reached, they want to experience all sorts of things, and so start imagining and cooking up ideas on the basis of their own limited understanding, and then they begin to perceive the things they expect to. Even in the case of a person who has reached the level of samadhi, if he is still not an adept, he can interpret and proliferate about his experience and then take himself to have derived some true knowledge from his meditation. A true meditator will be free of that desire for knowledge and will single-mindedly dedicate himself to the task of pacifying the mind. He will not worry whether or not any kind of gnosis arises during his practice, but will only be interested in the tranquility of samadhi. When that tranquil state of samadhi is firm and steady, wisdom will naturally arise, just as light and heat are inevitably produced by fire. A person who has developed firm and steady samadhi, one who interests himself only in diligently practicing night and day, giving no thought to tiredness and difficulties, one who considers the attainment of samadhi worth all the hardships, such a person is entitled to be called a wayfarer. At this point, I would like to go into the differences between jhana and samadhi more, to give something of a basic definition. Jhana and samadhi are not identical. The sages declare them to be different because the exposition of the factors of jhana is given separately from the exposition of the abandonment of defilements. Although jhana and samadhi share the same preliminary meditation objects, the mode of contemplation varies, as do the resultant knowledges that may arise. To take the contemplation of death as an example once more, in the case of jhana, there is a single-minded contemplation on the theme of death until the mind becomes motionless and firm and merges in bhavanga. Sometimes it may be a blank sort of stillness, devoid of self-awareness like the state of deep sleep, and may last for a long time, perhaps many hours. Other times there may survive a sense of pleasure in the tranquility and bliss of that state. To put it simply, the mind that concerns itself solely with a meditation object and then absorbs into bhavanga, whether accompanied by a complete loss of self-awareness or not, is called jhana. To enable the mind to merge into bhavanga and enjoy its undiluted tranquility and bliss is the sole aim of meditation. The word jhana means to gaze fixedly, to stare at or concentrate on. One may concentrate on something external, such as the four elements as one's object, or something inside the body, or the mind itself. In every case, when the concentration is single-minded and free of all other concerns, there is the jhanic suppression of defilements. When the mind withdraws from jhana, the defilements spring up as before. The Buddha explained unequivocally that jhana has five possible factors: vitakka, initial application; vichara, sustained application; piti, rapture; sukha, bliss; and ekagata, singleness. Jhana is described in terms of the arising, existence, and passing away of the bhavanga consciousness. Having entered jhana, five defilements are suppressed. Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. However, the Buddha never spoke of defilements being abandoned at different levels of jhana. I invite other wayfarers to investigate this point, and if you come across any such passages in the scriptures, kindly let me know. The Buddha, who has practiced in former lives, may realize many types of gnosis, but they will tend to be concerned with external matters and are unable to focus attention on the knower of those things. Just as the eye can see forms but cannot see itself. For instance, the meditator sees future events and past lives of himself and others, knows details of names, places, and relationships, but is ignorant of the chronology of rebirth or of the rebirth process. His gnosis is not subtle enough to discern which karmic actions have been performed to condition those births. This kind of gnosis arises in flashes. Its arising necessitates entry into bhavanga, which is characterized by a fuzziness similar to that preceding sleep, or else by the complete vanishing of self-consciousness and the sudden arising of a new awareness. In samadhi practice, you may take up the same preliminary subject as with jhana, or perhaps some theme of dhamma that arises naturally in the mind. For example, walking along the road, you see someone cruelly ill-treating an animal or another human being and feels great compassion arising. When you reflect on the matter until you see clearly that the lives of sentient beings are inevitably fraught with violence and cruelty. The small and weak fall prey to the aggression of the large and powerful. There will be no end to it as long as the world exists. Seeing this, one feels a profound and sobering sadness for all beings, including oneself. The mind shrinks, as does a chicken feather when singed by fire, and merges into the state of samadhi. In summary, jhana entails the steadfast contemplation of a meditation object in order to achieve absorption. Once that has occurred, the meditator takes delight in the resultant tranquility and bliss, and is reluctant to further contemplate. Samadhi entails a similar contemplation, but is guided by the wish to see the true nature of the object, without giving thought as to whether or not absorption will occur. There is merely the undeviating contemplation of the object for the purpose of seeing it clearly, and the integrity of that contemplation generates a spontaneous transition into the state of samadhi. It is rather like the freshness and brightness, the abatement of distraction that a meditator suffering from mental agitation may feel when shifting his seat to an airy, spacious place. Any gnosis that might arise in the state of samadhi does so in the same manner as in jhana, but awareness is not deceived. The meditator perceives the phenomenon as a man might observe a fish swimming in a glass tank. One who is adept at entering samadhi at any time, irrespective of posture, whether standing, sitting, walking, or lying down, is constantly primed for such knowledge to arise. There is the story of Venerable Moggallana seeing an enormous hungry ghost with a mouth the size of a needle's eye as he descended from Gijakuta Mountain. At the sight of such a being, a smile appeared on his lips. The other monks who were with him could not see the hungry ghost, and noticing Venerable Moggallana's smile, asked him the reason for it. Venerable Moggallana refused to answer, but said that the matter would be made clear to them when they reached the dwelling place of the Buddha. Having arrived and paid their respects, Venerable Moggallana related his encounter with the hungry ghost to the Buddha. The Buddha said, "I saw that hungry ghost myself when I was newly enlightened." Good. Today, Venerable Moggallana has become my witness. In talking about samadhi, we use its duration as the measure. When the meditator is still unproficient, the mind will enter samadhi weakly and intermittently. This is called kanaka samadhi. With practice, as one becomes more skilled, the mind will merge into samadhi for a longer time, which is called upachara. When one has trained the mind to an optimum level, the mind enters samadhi to its limit. It is called apana, or full samadhi. Only upachara will give rise to gnosis, which will tend to take the form of teachings or cautions. For example, if there should appear a vision of a large convocation hall with many monks gathered together inside, it would indicate that practice is proceeding correctly. If there appeared an uneven, overgrown path, and the monk walking along it slovenly dressed or else naked, it would indicate that practice has taken a wrong turn or it is lacking in some way. In relation to the abandonment of defilements, the Buddha taught that the stream enterer abandons the three fetters of self-view, skeptical doubt, and attachment to external observances. The once returner abandons the three initial fetters and in addition attenuates the sensual desire and aversion. The non-returner cuts off all five lower fetters. The arahant, as well as abandoning the five lower fetters, also rids himself of the craving for fine material existence, the craving for fine immaterial existence, conceit, unrest, and ignorance. To repeat, although both jhana and samadhi arise from the same meditation objects, the contemplation of them, the experience of entry into jhana and samadhi, and the kinds of gnosis that arise from them are all different. Meditators cannot prevent the arising of either jhana or samadhi. They form a pair, and one may change into the other. Sometimes the mind, having converged and entered jhana, perceives the inherent unsatisfactoriness of it and thus enters samadhi. At other times, while dwelling in samadhi over a period of time, mindfulness weakens and the mind moves into jhana. Jhana and samadhi cause and condition each other in this way. The Buddha said, "Where there is no jhana, there is no samadhi, and where there is no samadhi, there is no jhana." This is because they follow the same route. The differences lie only in the meditator. Some people harbour a deep fear that if their minds attain jhana, after death they will be reborn amongst the Brahma gods who lack perception, but those people usually have no idea what jhana actually is or what sort of mind takes such a rebirth. One who wishes to purify his heart and mind of all defilements must cleanse the mind. It is not necessary to cleanse the heart. When the mind has been cleansed, the heart becomes pure as a matter of course. The mind goes out in search of defilements to pollute itself, but when it has been cleansed, it becomes the heart. When wayfarers have realized their hearts and minds, even though they may not have learned the names of all the various defilements, they know for themselves the extent to which different actions and thoughts sully the mind. When they see the inherent unsatisfactoriness of the polluted mind, they are impelled to find skillful means to cleanse it. You don't need to know about every possible defilement before starting. In the first period after the Buddha's enlightenment, he and his disciples set out to disseminate the teaching. It is unlikely that very many of those who became enlightened as a result of their instructions had studied the teaching to any great extent. Venerable Sariputta, for instance, merely heard a summary of the doctrine from Venerable Asaji. All things arise from causes. The Buddha teaches the extinguishing of the root cause. And it was enough for him to realize the eye of Dhamma. As the number of teachings the Buddha gave increased, disciples memorized more and more of them, and the tradition of study came into being. Consequently, Buddhism was able to gradually spread over a huge area. Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's younger cousin and personal attendant, was unrivaled in his ability to memorize the teachings and was given the title of Bahusutta, greatly learned. Although he was able to teach many people to that level of full enlightenment, he himself, at the time of the Buddha's final Nibbana, was still only a stream enterer. A great Sangha council was convened for all the Arahant disciples to decide on what was and what was not the authentic teaching of the Buddha, and the presence of Ananda with his superb memory was deemed imperative. However, Venerable Ananda was not yet an Arahant, and so was precluded from attendance. On the day before the meeting, the leaders of the Sangha urged Venerable Ananda to intensify his efforts, and so he practiced ardently the whole night. But although he contemplated and examined every point of Dhamma he had learned in the Buddha's presence, his efforts bore no fruit. As dawn approached, exhausted, Venerable Ananda thought, "Never mind, if I don't realize Arahantship, it's all right," and laid down to take a rest. However, before his head reached the pillow, Venerable Ananda's mind converged into Maggasamangi, and he knew without a shadow of a doubt that he was enlightened. The person who wisely contemplates phenomena and searches out the cause and effect relationship conditioning them, who can let go and who can maintain equanimity in the midst of all things, is bound to penetrate the Dhamma to some extent, as did Venerable Ananda. In Buddhism, there are two tasks that those who have ordained and forsaken the responsibilities of the householder must perform: samatha and vipassana. The meditator who has gained proficiency in jhana and samadhi to the extent that the mind lies in his control can enter these states at will and dwell in them for as long as is desired. He can change the mode of contemplation from jhana to samadhi and vice versa, so that they become like playthings. This skill in the contemplation carries the training in vipassana within it, because jhana and samadhi entails contemplation of this same nama rupa, that is, the object of vipassana. There is a similar observation of dissolution, of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness and impersonality. But in the case of jhana and samadhi, the contemplation lacks comprehensiveness and only a weak understanding ensues. After a glimpse of the nature of things, the mind merges into tranquility that precludes the complete and thorough knowledge of vipassana. Vipassana may be compared to a sweet, ripe mango. When it first appears, the mango fruit has a bitter flavor, but as it gets a little bigger, the taste becomes astringent and with further growth becomes sour. Bigger still, it has a rich flavor, which has finally become sweet. The final sweetness of the mango is the consummation of all the tastes that have preceded it, and so is considered delicious. Similarly, it is fitting that vipassana has always been spoken of separately from jhana, which is subject to degeneration. Whether contemplating one of the preliminary objects, or the four elements, the five aggregates or the six sense fields, vipassana entails a clear knowing of the true nature of its objects, a letting go of attachment to it, and entrance into a state of equanimity. Vipassana means the clear perception of the true characteristics of things. When vipassana contemplation has become skilled and proficient, the meditator perceives forms, sounds, odors, flavors, tangibles, and mental objects, both internal and external, as impermanent, arising, changing, and finally disappearing according to their nature. Sentient beings take on the weight of transitory phenomena and so are subject to continuous suffering and discomfort. All things, whether material or immaterial, exist according to natural laws. However, we may seek to coerce them into following our will. It is beyond our power to do so. Anatta does not mean that nothing really exists, but that they exist in a way that is not subject to coercion. When the internal and external sense fields come into contact and give rise to feeling, those developing vipassana should at every moment and in every posture contemplate the process in terms of the three signs of experience, as outlined above. For one who is adept at this form of contemplation, it will become spontaneous, leaving no gap for defilements such as sensual desire to arise in the mind. The power generated by the development of jhana and samadhi and vipassana to a sufficient level of proficiency produces magga-samangi. Magga-samangi is not the same state as that of jhana or samadhi, but shares with them the process of the mind merging into a unified state. When vipassana contemplation has investigated inner and outer cause-effect relationships and has clearly seen their nature so as to be free of all doubts and uncertainties in regard to them, the mind will gather all eight factors of the path, in short, sila, samadhi and punya, together in one place of right view in a single thought moment. Subsequently, there will be a withdrawal into the realm of the sense, but experience in that realm will now be constantly accompanied by a clear knowing of the true nature of sense objects, and the mind will not be deluded by them in the same way as before. The Buddha taught that each path consciousness arises once and only once. After attaining the first magga, one continues to develop vipassana in the same manner as before, but however clearly things are seen, if the insight does not exceed the penetration of that first magga, it is not called magga-samangi. It is just as if on waking up from sleep you are able to accurately relate a dream you have just had. You do not take the relating of it to be the dream itself. The progressively higher magga-samangi occur naturally as the wisdom faculty, strongly developed, becomes fluent and skilled. The consciousness of each level of the noble path will be an indisputable indication of that attainment, but the knowledge that one derives is a private one. No one else can share it until they too reach that stage. Knowledge of the attainments of another through psychic powers, by one on a higher level of attainment, or else by close observation is possible, but in the last analysis remains unreliable. Whether the wayfarer studies as lot or as little, or if he studies only the particular meditation object that he has chosen, if he wishes to attain one-pointedness, then he must discard everything extraneous and concentrate single-mindedly on the contemplation of his object. In the case of one developing vipassana, even though there is a continuation of the mental activity that is natural to a living human being, the wayfarer knows it for what it is, sees it in the light of the three characteristics, impermanence, suffering, and not self, and is not deluded by it. The sense data that are experienced, whether by eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, or mind, are invariably an obstacle to jhana and samadhi, and imperil the attainment of them. One who sees the unsatisfactoriness inherent in sensory experience will of a sudden lose interest in it, will see the virtue of the mind at peace, devoid of sensory impingement, and so will converge into a hermetic and tranquil motionlessness. On withdrawal from that state, the mind resumes its old activities until, perceiving again the unsatisfactory nature of those experiences, it renounces them and returns to unity. This process repeats itself until there is a fluency and skill, until one sees that all sensory experience is merely that, phenomena appearing and disappearing in accordance with their nature. One sees that the mind is separate from it, sufficient unto itself. The mind is not experience. experience is not the mind, but experience depends for its existence on the mind's grasping at sense objects. When this distinction is made, the mind becomes solitary and secluded and turns into the heart. Buddhist knowledge appears profound and extensive only to one who has not realized the heart itself, but knows only of its expressions, the mind. Such a person speaks of the thoughts and concepts of the mind, but fails to intuit the heart, the hub of equanimity. It is like someone following the tracks of a cow. Until he sees the cow and catches hold of it, he has to just keep on following the tracks. Once the cow has been caught, however, the tracks lose their significance for him. It is the same with the Buddha's teachings. They seem to be complex and difficult to understand as long as we haven't taken the mind into the heart. Merely following the mind, the expressions of the heart, we reach no end. The Abhidhamma has its exposition of cittas, the various kinds of consciousness in the form realms, the formless realm, and the transcendent consciousness. The states of mind are divided, classified, and numbered in great detail in order that they may be recognized and understood and elude us. But those who memorize all those categories tend to get attached to that level of understanding and never reach the heart. Consequently, for them, Buddhism becomes an extensive and profound subject, the study of which never reaches an end. It is as if the Buddha were to say to us, "I followed the cow's tracks for countless lifetimes. Even in this lifetime, as Siddhartha, I followed them for another 6 years until I came across the cow." So it may be said that on realization of the heart, Buddhism becomes narrow, not narrow in the sense of a constriction or a deficiency of any sort, but in that we come to dwell on only the most cogent or essential points of a vast subject. For instance, our minds are churned up by our own and other people's mental states, and the range of experience so produced may be called wide. However, one who sees the inherent unsatisfactoriness in mental disquiet, sees the suffering of it, contemplates that the mental state and the mind that is agitated by it are different, and so separates them. When the mind has been separated from the mental state, dwelling alone, it becomes the heart. The mental state vanishes by itself. At this point, we may see particularly clearly that mankind's experience of defilement and mental suffering is invariably due to the mind's own actions in venturing out and appropriating them. If the mind does not do so, then it becomes the heart, and, free of concerns, it enjoys unalloyed happiness. A banana tree has no heartwood. However much you chop away at one, all you will find is layer after layer of stem. Meditators, on the other hand, are chopping away the layers that surround the true heartwood of the Dhamma. Those who seek the essence of Dhamma but have not yet seen it are those that have not yet cut through the layers that surround it. Meditators who have not yet penetrated to the heart often have a deep fear that should the mind reach the heart, no insight will arise, and without insight there can be no end of suffering, only continued ignorance. Even senior monks have spoken to me in this vein. I explained to them that the mind seeks out experiences to occupy itself. When the mind sees the unsatisfactoriness inherent in such activity, it converges into a unitary state and becomes the heart. It is not that this transformation occurs without a thoroughly circumspect reflection preceding it. There is a contemplation of every aspect of the matter until one perceives the three signs. The mind enters the heart because it has nowhere else to go. That being so, how could there be an absence of wisdom? There is the wisdom that corresponds to one's level of attainment. The mind is the cause of defilement. Defilement could not take place if the mind did not exist. The mind is also the cause of wisdom. Without it, one would be unable to use the thinking process to generate wisdom. The mind is the cause of defilement, while its restless wandering prevents it from realizing the neutrality of the heart. The mind becomes the cause of wisdom when, roving around the sensory world, it gathers all its experience within the three characteristics and stops motionless, equanimous, and self-aware. It reaches the heart. Silkworms are fed on mulberry and gradually change into caterpillars. When mature as caterpillars, they spin out cocoons for themselves and become chrysalizers. And when their time in that state is over, they emerge and are called insects, whereupon they lay eggs in vast quantities, tens or hundreds of thousands. The mind is the same. When it is absorbed in the heart, it is devoid of activity. But once it has emerged, its expressions are uncountable. The sages do not allow the mind to wander out and be reborn again. They eliminate it at a single stroke. In summary, all the defilements of mankind arise solely from the mind when it embroils itself in the contact between the six external sense fields, such as forms, sounds, and the six internal sense fields, such as the eyes, ears, and so on. The children and grandchildren born of these liaisons spread throughout the world, causing like and dislike, love and hate, anger and abhorrence, violence and killing, bringing utter turmoil to the world. Recognizing this danger, those who practice Dhamma should beware of letting their minds become embroiled in the process of sense contact. Make the heart neutral and impassive. Even if the mind uses the sense fields as a vehicle for its travels, one should watch over the heart and not let it be misled. When the heart remains undeceived by the mind, through knowing the mind's nature, how it proliferates sense data into states of turmoil, the heart will dwell alone in its natural way. When the heart thus accords with its true nature, the imaginings of the mind will abate, for the heart is without coming or going, inner or outer, pleasure or displeasure. Grasping at nothing, it is impassive in the midst of all things, and in its presence the mind will fall down unabashed. When the wayfarer clearly sees the true nature of things in this way, he will see that there is nothing, either material or immaterial, that is anything more than a mere phenomenon, arising in dependence on causes and conditions, and disappearing when those causes and conditions no longer obtain. He sees that there is absolutely nothing substantial. He sees this little country which is our body, a fathom long, a cubit wide, and a few inches thick, as a container filled full of Dhammas. The eye sees a form, and it is perceived as merely a Dhamma of form, nothing else. The ear hears a sound, and it is perceived as simply a Dhamma. The nose smells an odor, the tongue tastes a flavor, the body contacts a tangible object, and the heart contacts a mental object, and in every case, they are seen to be merely Dhammas, not a being, not a self, a personality, or anything at all. That concludes the Dhamma teaching, Only the World Ends, by the Venerable Ajahn Tate. If you'd like to hear more talks by Ajahn Tate and other meditation masters of the forest tradition of Theravada Buddhism, subscribe to the Forest Path podcast using your favorite podcast app. I want to thank the recent supporters for their donations that have been received via Ko-fi in the past month. These donations pay for the online services like podcast hosting, web hosting, and the online tools that make these podcasts available for free. Your generous support makes Dhamma available and free of charge for all. Thank you so much for your kind support. The Forest Path podcast is part of the Everyday Dhamma network. If you go to everydaydhamma.net, you can discover more about the other podcasts on the network also. This podcast is produced and narrated by me, Sol Hanna. If you like these audio resources that I'm making available for free in a convenient podcast format, you may want to become a supporter via the Ko-Fi Creators platform. There are links in the description below. Thank you for listening. May you all experience insight and peace. Thank you.